Chapter 3. We're in deep shit. There is an axiom in American journalism that goes something like this. There is always a guy. Whatever the assignment, however arcane the subject, there is always one person who has devoted obsessive amounts of time to understanding it, to collecting evidence and data and sharing it with anyone who will listen. To the casual observer, these people may seem too odd to be taken seriously. Their years of being ignored may have made them a bit too gruff or obscene for the average bureaucrat to bear. But that doesn't make them wrong. When it comes to masks, Mike Bowen is the guy. Tall and sturdy despite his years, with soft green eyes that betray his Texas tough persona. Bowen walked confidently through the side entrance glass doors of Prestige Ameritech, a crumbling factory and warehouse outside Dallas. He passed the counter where security used to be, down a long tiled hallway with an atrium overhead, scattered light popping through grime-frosted glass. He turned right past a trash can that collects rain when it comes, and marched along the next unlit hallway, atop loose, wrinkled, and stained blue and pink carpet from the 1980s. To his left stood the dusty glass showcase Prestige Ameritech staged in 2010 for a ribbon-cutting ceremony with Governor Rick Perry, who'd come to show off Texas's bustling job market and the rare resurrection of an American factory. The masks and respirators inside the case, propped up and folded next to their branded boxes, had not been touched since Perry's visit a decade earlier. Bowen, 62, had worked in this factory, the largest remaining domestic manufacturer of medical masks, since the carpet in its sales office was new and arguably fashionable. The office, along with the vast and better-maintained manufacturing warehouse behind it, had changed hands several times over the years. But Bowen somehow stuck to the place, and the dream dying within it. First, it belonged to Technol Medical Products, which Bowen recalls supplied about 9 out of every 10 surgical masks in the United States. In 1997, medical supply giant Kimberly-Clark acquired Technol, its facilities, and hundreds of employees. Bowen stayed on as an executive. But the company soon downsized and closed the plant. Bowen found other work. That was until 2005, when a former Technol colleague and soon-to-be business partner invited Bowen aboard a new company with plans to buy back the mothballed plant at a discount. Together, the two resolved to resurrect domestic mask manufacturing, which had been offshored due to globalization and cheaper labor and production costs in China and Mexico. Hospitals and their market-dominant buying groups wanted to pay the lowest price possible, and big companies, including 3M, Honeywell, Cardinal Health, and Medline, looked to foreign materials and production in a race to the bottom. Bowen believed that the company could buck the trend and attract dedicated American customers with a simple and, so he thought, unassailable argument. Domestic mask production is vital to national security. It was idealistic, if not altogether naive. And the years since had not been kind. On January 22, 2020, in the dim and empty wing that was once the accounting department, Bowen arrived at his office and dropped his backpack on a large oak desk, where reports and old letters and surgical masks and trinkets coalesced into entropy, a reflection of the memories, anger, and concerns bopping around his head. Buried in stacks and files around him, Bowen kept every warning he'd ever fired off, to Congress, to 3 presidential administrations, to newspapers, to officials overseeing the national stockpile, and to an array of other agencies that would soon blast from obscurity into the American consciousness. In 2007, he wrote to veteran Texas Congresswoman Kay Granger, "Virtually all of the U.S. medical face mask companies have gone offshore, leaving the U.S. dependent upon foreign governments who, in a pandemic, will retain face masks for their own populations, leaving Americans unprotected. In June 2010, he wrote several letters to President Barack Obama's White House. In a 1918-type pandemic, it is likely that the U.S. won't have surgical masks unless you encourage the rebuilding of the U.S. mask-making industry. Also, unless the U.S. mask supply is brought back under American control, Americans may die needlessly in future pandemics. In October 2013, he wrote to Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, "If there is a severe pandemic, due to the fact that it is imported and foreign-controlled, the U.S. mask supply could be cut off." And in a letter dated February 2017, Bowen took a shot at speaking then-President Donald Trump's language. 90% of the United States' protective mask supply is currently foreign-made. At industry conferences and in phone calls and emails with federal officials for 13 years, Bowen had made the case. But by 2019, all but one office in the federal emergency response apparatus had tuned him out. That agency was the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA. Immensely important, yet chronically overlooked, with about $1.5 billion a year, BARDA funds research and development of vaccines and other medical countermeasures in anticipation of epidemics and nuclear or biological attacks. It's a sister agency of the Strategic National Stockpile, under HHS, but BARDA's money and work are tied up with the biomedical industry and in scientific pursuit, not in buying masks. If Bowen's only motivation was to sell his products, he'd endeared himself to the wrong agency, and he knew as much. But Bowen appreciated that someone was listening and didn't think he was nuts. Due in part to his persistence, BARDA leaders came to share his concerns. And for his self-effacing candor, they came to even like the mask fanatic down in Texas. For years, they'd quietly encourage Bowen to keep up the pressure because nothing was being done within HHS. He became, in essence, an unofficial spokesman, and an outspoken one at that. Through years of emails, texts, and phone calls, Bowen had established a rapport with BARDA's longest-serving director, Robin Robinson. When Robinson left that post after the 2016 election, that relationship fell to his successor, an accomplished immunologist named Dr. Rick Bright. Having run the agency's influenza program since 2011, Bright was more than familiar with Bowen. And though the two wouldn't find occasion to meet in person, over the next 3 years, Bowen and Bright became something approaching friends, bonded by a common fear. In the early weeks of January 2020, Bowen glued himself to the virus that had found its way into humans at a giant market in Wuhan, China. As with previous outbreaks or bad flu seasons, Bowen watched for clues to see if the company should speed up production. What little we knew, in part because the virus was new, and in part because China was concealing its true wrath, was concerning. The virus appeared to spread and attack efficiently, ravaging the respiratory systems of its victims. But it was what he saw in his company's own sales data that scared the hell out of him. In the second and third weeks of January, Prestige Ameritech had noticed a dramatic uptick in small purchases of N95s from a seldom-used corner of its website. The company's bread and butter was wholesale production for large buyers of cheap surgical masks. But the company decided to dabble in by-the-case sales after multiple inquiries from patients who'd been treated at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. The site was not a moneymaker, taking in just $1,900 in 2019. And because it was a tiny part of the business, Bowen's daughter, a member of the sales team, set up her phone to ding each time a purchase had come through. This ensured smaller shipments were handled promptly outside of the routine business. By the second week of 2020, the dings were picking up, and by the third, they were incessant. Curious, Bowen and his daughter pulled up the purchase data and noticed that many of the surnames on the orders seemed to be Asian. Some customers had come back multiple times to order, and the orders were growing in quantity. Bowen suspected the orders were coming from Chinese Americans who were sending masks to family in China and Hong Kong. In 3 decades in the mask business, he'd seen nothing like it. It was time to write to Bright. Later that day, January 22nd, Bowen fired off an email that, had the Trump administration acted upon it, might have saved innumerable American lives. "Rick, we still have 4 like-new N95 manufacturing lines," Bowen began. "To activate them, we'd need more people, raw materials, emergency approval, and large, non-cancelable orders. Reactivating these machines would be very difficult and very expensive, but could be achieved in a dire situation and with government help." He closed. "Rick, I hope that your and my predictions about the foreign-made U.S. mask supply don't come true." 1,500 miles away in Washington, D.C., Bright was fighting hard and losing badly. He had been pleading with senior HHS officials to obtain genetic sequencing information from the Chinese CDC and a specimen of the virus from infected people. If both were disseminated through the country's large patchwork of public and private laboratories, the United States could swiftly develop a diagnostic test, key to containing spread, and begin work on a potential vaccine. Following updates from the scientific community and media reports in early January, he could see that COVID-19 was highly contagious, likely more fatal than the average flu, and that the country needed to prepare for imminent spread beyond China. He'd requested funding, more people, more urgency, but senior officials at HHS were downplaying the virus, both in private and in public. He was among the world's leading experts in vaccines, therapeutics, and testing, but within his own chain of command had come to be viewed as a nuisance. His relationship with his boss, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response Robert Kadlec, the ASPR, had been strained since 2017, when the two had clashed over how lucrative BARDA contracts were being steered to politically connected firms outside of traditional contract vetting. Bright viewed their standing as not great, nor altogether acrimonious, but simply tolerable. So Bright was stunned to find himself in 2020 being sidelined by Kadlec and other HHS leaders from key meetings and discussions about a threat over which BARDA had direct purview and expertise. Kadlec and the resources he commanded as ASPR were focused on repatriating and quarantining U.S. citizens coming back from China, part of the fantastical hope that the virus wouldn't penetrate U.S. borders. Bright questioned the strategy. The virus was already hopping the globe, in fact, with the first confirmed case outside of China arriving January 12th in Thailand. The World Health Organization was already advising other nations to prepare. Bright had nudged Kadlec the next week, on January 18th, to assemble cross-agency senior-level meetings called the Disaster Leadership Group. Those meetings would bring leaders and key people from BARDA, HHS, CDC, the Defense Department, and the National Institutes of Health together to get on the same page and free up and direct resources. Such meetings had been beneficial during past outbreaks, including response to the Ebola and Zika virus scares in 2014 and 2015. But Kadlec wanted to slow play it, writing to Bright in an email that he was not sure if that is a time-sensitive urgency. Among several good reasons to hold the meeting, cash needed to be moved around. Bright controlled BARDA, but its hands were tied, its money already dedicated to work with the private sector. It wasn't yet clear who would be doing what or who was paying for it, though it was clear to Bright that someone should be doing something and there should be a boatload more funding to do it. Another key priority, making sure the country had ample stocks of N95 respirators, surgical masks, cotton swabs, nitrile gloves, all materials that were susceptible to a potential supply chain disruption. If hospitals were overrun, Bright understood, the increased use of these items to treat patients, the burn rate, would far exceed the supply chain's ability to restock shelves. Cheap personal protective equipment was the single best defense. Without it, healthcare providers would be exposed to a contagion the U.S. government knew little about, and Americans would die. Supply chain issues fell to ASPR's Critical Infrastructure and Protection Division, which Bright was astonished to find hadn't mobilized in any significant way. It was in this bureaucratic tangle that Bright received Bowen's January 22nd email from Texas. Bright read it and thought maybe such an update from the front line, from the mask guy, could at least speed up the supply angle. Hoping to guilt his colleagues into doing their jobs, Bright did what any civilized office dweller would do. He CC'd a bunch of people. Mike, thank you for reaching out to me about this important resource and plan, Bright wrote to Bowen and an audience of other key HHS officials. I am connecting you all directly in hope of expediting a conversation, he continued. Thank you for all that you are doing. Your leadership in this area remains an important resource for our nation and public health. A few hours passed, and just minutes before the end of the workday, Laura Wolf, Director of Critical Infrastructure and Protection, responded to Bowen's email, writing, I don't believe we as a government are anywhere near answering those questions. I'm dealing with a sick kiddo, and that may spill over into tomorrow, Wolf wrote. Bright's passive-aggressive email seemed to have worked, though not with the immediacy he had hoped. Wolf pushed the discussion until 2 days later, Friday, January 24th. After speaking with Wolf, Bowen followed up Friday evening with an exhaustive breakdown of his read on potential mask shortages and of what his facility could do if the United States made formal commitments to purchase masks off machines. Elegantly simple but expensive machines that needed engineers to be fired up. It took me all day to write this, Bowen wrote to Bright and Wolf. My phone rang off the wall with mask requests. Last week, nobody wanted to hear me. This week, I'm quite popular. Bowen had plenty of business coming from private buyers, he explained. Too much business. He was simply trying to spur the government to buy masks, if not from him, then from one of the many competitors he had shared with Bright. Prestige Ameritech could activate new assembly lines for N95s, but it would only make financial sense if the U.S. government committed to buying off those lines through the crisis and beyond. The last time Bowen had fired up new production lines, hiring hundreds of workers, was during the 2009 H1N1 swine flu epidemic. After the virus disappeared, so did the government investment. His business partner, Dan Reese, was forced to wind down the machines and lay off 150 employees. It brought the men to tears. The company narrowly avoided bankruptcy. The next day, Saturday, Bowen sent another warning to Bright and Wolf, forwarding an email he'd received from a government official in Hong Kong. The official wanted to buy more than 10 million N95s, an astronomical outlier of an order. As the federal government sat on its hands, other countries were scrambling to secure what supplies the country had from right under its nose. And it was driving Bowen batshit. The next day, Sunday, Bowen wrote to Bright and Wolf that he feared China would soon cut off mask exports, choking off as much as 90% of masks that make their way to doctors' offices and hospitals. The U.S. mask supply is at imminent risk, he wrote at 10:15 p.m. An hour later, just to Bright, he wrote, Rick, I think we're in deep shit. The world. At 4 in the morning, now Monday, Bright asked, Mike, have you ramped up production to full capacity? At 6:31 a.m., Bowen replied, We are planning. We have to be cautious. It's dangerous. The hard landing after H1N1 nearly put us out of business. News outlets were catching up to the looming mask shortage, thanks in part to Bowen and others who were reaching out to reporters. Home improvement and drugstores were beginning to see people making a run on supplies. Attempting to get ahead of panic buying, HHS told the news site Axios that the risk to the public was low, and that the Strategic National Stockpile holds millions of face masks as well as N95 respirators that could be used, if needed, in responding to a public health emergency. But as would repeatedly play out over the course of 2020, what the Trump administration told the public did not reflect the panic within. A couple of miles away at the White House, Peter Navarro, a top advisor to the president, was doing his part to light a fire under the administration at a critical time. Brusque and confident, Navarro was an economist and a self-proclaimed expert on China, known most for his influence over and support of Trump's trade wars. Unlike most other Trump lieutenants, Navarro was immediately concerned about the outbreak in China, a country he distrusted so much he wrote a whole book about it. On January 29th, Navarro dispersed a cogent and fearful memo to the White House, warning that the coronavirus could take 500,000 American lives and cost the country trillions of dollars. The lack of immune protection or an existing cure or vaccine would leave Americans defenseless in the case of a full-blown coronavirus outbreak on U.S. soil, Navarro wrote. That same day, Trump announced a White House task force to prepare for outbreaks in the United States. That Friday, January 31st, the White House announced it would bar entry of foreign nationals who'd visited China, a move pushed by Navarro. Navarro was not yet aware of what was happening with Bright at HHS and Bowen at Prestige Ameritech, but the three were on a collision course to becoming uneasy allies for a time. The force that would bring them together? None other than Steve Bannon. Because, of course, Steve Bannon. By the first days of February, Bowen realized that his friend Bright didn't have the sway needed to escalate the nation's preparation effort. So he turned to the press, securing an interview with the New York Times, some broadcast interviews, and a write-up at Wired.com. As word of his travails spread, Bowen got a call from a producer at War Room, the podcast hosted by Bannon, a former top advisor to Trump who still held clout in the administration, despite leaving the White House in a delightful tizzy and saying on his way out that the president was like an 11-year-old child. In addition to having led the once-fringe right-wing website Breitbart, Bannon had run the successful Trump campaign and its hollow promise to keep and rebuild vestigial American manufacturing. Bowen's story, and his company's near-religious defiance of market forces in the name of American patriotism, was a natural fit and a legitimate news story. Bowen was intrigued, but had reservations. A lifelong Republican, he had voted for Trump in 2016. But while observing the man's many indecencies over 3 years as president, Bowen had come to regret the vote, and in fact, had begun to consume less Fox News and more MSNBC. Still, he knew Bannon had powerful friends and harbored a like-minded disdain for cheap Chinese manufacturing. "Well, okay," Bowen told Bannon's producer. "But I fucking hate Donald Trump. Is that a problem?" "Well, can you just not say that on the air?" the producer asked on the phone. "Yeah, I just want you to know who you're talking to here. I am not a Donald Trump supporter." Somewhere in his discussions with the producer and Bannon's co-host, Bowen was asked what could be done. He said the CDC and the White House needed to immediately invest in new mask machines and place large orders with every manufacturer it could find. They needed to listen to Rick Bright at BARDA. The podcast wouldn't air for more than a week, but Bannon's team promised to use its connections to get word to the White House, specifically to Navarro. On the evening of February 5th, Bowen sent an email to Bright with the subject, Prepare for a call from the White House. Rick, I'm pretty sure that my mask supply message will be heard by President Trump this week. I'm getting a ton of press, and I'm passing out your email address and saying that you're the guy who knows that I'm telling the truth. I'm handing you the power to fix the U.S. mask supply. Please don't let Americans down. No pressure, Bright thought. Cadillac, who did not respond to my request for an interview or comment, had finally called for regular disaster leadership group meetings, though Bright found that the group illustrated more disaster than leadership. During such a meeting, on February 7th, Bright presented to HHS and CDC officials data that Bowen had sent about his company's spike in sales. A jump Bowen estimated showed demand was about 200 times the existing supply of masks in the country. What would the country do, Bright asked, if this trend continued and there wasn't more supply coming in? His colleagues, including Wolf, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Director with whom Bowen had spoken, didn't buy it. There was enough supply for now, Bright was told. Bright knew it was bullshit. Earlier that morning, he stopped by the Home Depot in Northeast Washington, D.C. Inside, he found two Asian women staring up in anticipation as a worker pulled the last case of 3M respirators from the overhead bins. "Don't you understand?" one woman said to him. "We need all of these for our family. There's a virus in China." As the worker dropped the last of the N95s to the floor, Bright lunged in and snatched a box. It was uncharacteristic, but he knew that might be the last box of masks in the entire city. Bright took a picture of the Home Depot tableau and told his colleagues what he had witnessed. That's when he was told that HHS would simply ask the CDC to issue guidance that people who don't need masks, well, they shouldn't buy them. Bright was furious. This was not a solution. While it is true that medical-grade masks should be reserved for healthcare workers, it was well established that masks help prevent disease spread through air, a fact the public would learn sooner or later. That's not what happened in 2009. In 2010, Bright remembers saying, people panicked. They hoarded the supplies of masks and respirators. The same with Tamiflu and other drugs, anything they could get their hands on. So it won't work to just change the CDC guidance. Well, that's the only methodology HHS and the CDC were considering, Bright was told. He began to believe his colleagues were not just negligent, but downright lazy. He looked to his colleagues and said, "You have got to be kidding me. I can't believe that you can sit there and say that with a straight face." He left in disbelief and called Bowen. "Mike, they're not listening to me." Bowen twisted off into a profanity-laden lament. Later that same day, Navarro's assistant called the HHS switchboard and asked for some guy named Rick Bright, whom no one at the White House had ever heard of. The assistant got through to Bright's desk line and told him that he was being summoned to the White House to discuss the coronavirus. Bright was astonished that his pen pal down in Texas had managed to get the attention of the Trump White House. Behind the scenes, HHS officials were nervous that their own fly in the ointment was now taking his case to the most powerful office in the world. They tried to stall the meeting, but after an insistent call from Navarro himself to Cadillac, Bright was cleared to go to the White House the next day, a Saturday. Just before 2 p.m., Bright arrived at the White House in a pressed suit. When Bright entered his office, Navarro, wearing jogging shorts and a t-shirt, jumped right in. "Why are you all dressed up?" Navarro asked. "Well, I'm coming to a meeting in the White House," Bright responded. "First question," Navarro said. Bright nodded. "Is this real?" Navarro said. "Yes, I'm afraid it is," Bright responded. "Second, what do we need to do about it?" Navarro asked. "There are a lot of things we need to do right now," Bright said. Before he could elaborate, Navarro slapped a book on the table. It was 3 seconds until midnight, a book whose primary author was Stephen Hatfill, a controversial virologist and associate of Bannon's, who, in the early 2000s, gained fame for being wrongly suspected by the FBI as the perpetrator behind the anthrax letter attacks. Drawing from the 1918 influenza pandemic, Hatfill's book was published in the fall of 2019 and warned that the United States was unprepared for the next pandemic. "Have you read this book?" asked Navarro. Bright said he hadn't, noticing Navarro had several copies on his desk. "Go home. Read this book," Bright remembers Navarro telling him, "and come back and see me tomorrow. Come back with 5 points, the most important things you think we should do." Navarro gave Bright a 20-page white paper, also written by Hatfill, that distilled some of the book's larger points and purported to break down everything the United States needed to do to address a pandemic. As Bright left the room, Navarro boomed, "And don't dress up." Bright returned to Navarro's office the next day, Sunday, dressed down. This time Navarro had another guest in attendance, Hatfill, the author of the book. For his prescience, Navarro in the coming weeks would enlist Hatfill's counsel and insert him directly into the middle of the White House's response efforts. Navarro's affinity would give Hatfill, and some of his more controversial ideas and whims, outsized influence over the White House response. Bright had perused the materials the night before, but believed the book lacked substance. "Did you read the book?" Navarro asked. "No, I glanced at it," Bright responded, Hatfill in the corner of his eye. "I wasn't impressed with it." Navarro, whose no-bullshit mantra was the stuff of legend in the West Wing, smirked. Bright interpreted this as one straight shooter recognizing another, and in this moment felt genuine relief that someone with true power understood the urgency the situation required. Bright was eager to jump into the key steps he'd drafted up the night before. He started with the mask supply and an imminent shortage that would contribute to untold infections and deaths. Bright said the United States needed to immediately place large orders for masks with various manufacturers and needed to halt the export of PPE outside the U.S. And yesterday, Navarro was curious to know how Bright knew so much about masks and supply chains. "Who do you talk to about this?" Navarro asked Bright. "I talk to the CEOs and heads of these mask companies," Bright said. "Who do you know in the mask companies?" Navarro asked. "I know Mike Bowen," Bright responded. "I can get him on speakerphone right now." Navarro agreed, and Bright dialed Bowen. "I'm standing here in Peter Navarro's office," Bright said. "So you need to watch your language. Tell me once again, what needs to be done? Tell me about these idle pieces of equipment and what it would take to get them up and running." Bowen explained the finer details of the N95 machines he had sitting in the warehouse, which the company had purchased after a competitor went out of business. He couldn't fire them up without a guarantee from the government that they'd purchase off those lines. It was too expensive and complicated, and those masks would need emergency clearance from NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which certifies masks claiming to filter out 95% of particles. That could take months. As a stopgap, Bowen explained that his business partner and fabricator was building additional machines to produce masks, for which the company already had NIOSH approval, itself a complicated process. With both lines of effort and buy-in from the government, the company could spit out 10 million masks a month. After the call, Bright and Navarro worked together to draft a memo to the White House Coronavirus Task Force, then overseen by HHS Secretary Alex Azar. It called for 3 immediate steps. 1. Halt the export of N95 masks and ramp up U.S. production. 2. Secure all existing doses of and materials needed to brew remdesivir, a therapeutic scientists believed could help infected patients recover. 3. Fund and launch a Manhattan Project-style effort to develop a vaccine. For the first time in weeks, Bright felt optimistic that the country could get ahead of the virus. He left Navarro's office, went home, and worked through most of the night. At 4:26 a.m. on February 10th, he texted Bowen. "Thank you." "I'm up if you need me," Bowen replied. He was preparing for interviews with the China Morning Post and the BBC. "I'm about to create a shitstorm. Get ready." "You've been very generous," Bright responded. "I can't thank you enough. I might need more info today, but I'll let you know. Try to rest some, too. This could be a marathon. I think we are running up a steep hill right now. Pace."